My name is Ed Goldberg, and I am speaking with, I have the pleasure to speak with, Jeffrey Deaver. Jeffrey, welcome back to KBOO.
Good to
back
see you
to
again.
Portland. Yeah, it's good to see you again, too. Yes. I missed you last time around.
Yeah, sorry. That was a few years ago, but now we're back again.
I got a bio here, and you can say, oh, that's not true if you want.
The good stuff is true.
A former journalist, folk singer, and attorney. True?
All true.
Folk singer, your own stuff?
Well, actually, because I had marginal musical talent, I wanted to squeak by on my songwriting ability, and I wrote many, many songs. My idols were Bob Dylan, Paul Simon, Peter, Paul, and Mary, Jackson Brown.
The usual suspects.
The usual suspects, exactly. But I never really got into the whole ensemble music thing. I would at most have maybe backup bass player or something. I played guitar, but it was all about my writing. And then I learned that to be a singer-songwriter, part of that, songwriter part is fine, but the singer part, you need both of them, and I really wasn't much of a singer.
I wish I could have seen you back in those days.
I enjoyed it, yes.
Okay. Your novels have appeared in a number of bestseller lists around the world, including the New York Times, the Times of London, and the L.A. Times. Any place that's not called Times?
Let me think. The Sydney Morning Herald.
There you go.
How's that?
You were born in Glen Ellen, Illinois. You're an Illinois kid?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
is that near Chicago?
About 30 miles outside of Chicago. Uh-huh. Yeah, the burbs. Uh-huh. And it was a wonderful place to grow up. The village was probably 180 years old, kind of a horse stop. We had a George Washington slept here place. Now, I didn't know he got that far.
Illinois?
Yeah. But so I'm thinking, you know, maybe the public relations firm of the town was playing with us a little bit. But it had some historical roots, but a very nice place to grow up.
Okay. You're here with your latest Lincoln Rhyme book. We'll get to that in a minute. Most popular series feature Lincoln Rhyme and his main squeeze and partner, Amelia Sachs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You're presently alternating your series with the Catherine Dance series, a character introduced in a Lincoln Rhyme novel.
Yeah, in the I don't want to go. You can kick me if we're going off on tangents, but I will say that I always listen to what my fans like. I read all my fan mail, and if they like something, I pursue it. If they don't, I'll change it. I write for them. You know, it's not about me. It's about my fans. And
God, you're such a saint.
They love they love this character, Catherine Dance, who appeared in the Cold Moon about three, four years ago. And and she was actually an appealing character, kinesics expert, body language expert, and a detective, a police officer in California. So I spun her off, and those books have done very well, too.
Okay. Virtually all of your works feature a trick ending or sometimes multiple trick endings.
Surprise, surprise.
Yes, I really love that. I have a hard time plotting, and a guy like you who wastes more plot in a book than I can think of in a year.
Well, that's very kind of you. I write the kind of book that I enjoy reading, and you know, I hate picking up a book that maybe starts out with a good premise, and then you can tell the author just doesn't have any ideas where to take it, and it plods on, prose, explanation, but let's get those twists, let's get those turns going.
Okay, now this is your big news, and this really is big news. You will write the next James Bond novel.
Yes, yes.
The novel known as Project X, wink, wink, until the title is announced, set in the present era. So Bond must be, what, about 84 years old now? Yeah.
Oh, no, we have to back up about that. He was born in 1981. I'm serious. This is a reboot. This is a reboot. We are starting over again, and I'll tell you sort of how, if you're interested, how all this came about. About 4 or 5 years ago, I won a prize called The Steel Dagger. It was offered by the Crime Writers Association of England, and it was sponsored, this particular award was sponsored by the Ian Fleming Estate. And it was really given to the book that was the most in keeping with the tradition of Ian Fleming's work, the James Bond books. And in fact, mine was a historical thriller, Garden of Beasts, and it involved kind of a spy hitman. And it was my favorite book of the ones I've written. Loved it. Well, the Ian Fleming estate loved it too. And when I accepted the award, I made some truthful and very kind comments about Ian Fleming, who was a big influence when I was young and becoming a writer. They apparently took note of that, and then last fall they called me up and said, Jeff, would you be interested in writing a new James Bond novel? And what they wanted was for me to continue the spirit of Bond. Now, Bond, I should say, was a very complex character. Many of your listeners are going to know him from the movies, but that's quite a different character than the fellow in the books. He was first of all, he was very heroic. He was very, very flawed in many ways. He was a real spy. He had edges to him, hard edges to him, and he was cynical. He was very smart, but he was a, you know, he was a hired killer. Basically, he worked for a secret government agency that would occasionally kill people. He
didn't Hence always the double do that, zero designation.
That's what it stood for. Yeah. And I said, you know, I'm so honored you're asking me, but I, to be honest with you, I'm not convinced a period piece is what I want to do. And they said, oh no, 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 we want to start over again. We want him to be our James Bond, but in your, that is Jeffrey Deaver's era, with Jeffrey Deaver's accoutrements of the book. And those are the, as you were mentioning, the twists and turns, the very fast time frame, the typical book of mine. The Burning Wire, for instance, takes place over about 2 days. And I will bring that to the Bond project. So I know people, when they say it's set in 2011, which is when the book will appear, people say, well, isn't James getting a bit of an age? And I say, oh, no, he was born in the 80s, which I was born in 1950. That's shocking for me to say that. But he's the age of many secret agents and special ops and so forth. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Right. Well, that leads to a bunch of questions. And I know that you're under some kind of a stricture about what you can actually say about the project.
Well, that's true. But it's also true that I'm in the process of writing it now, and there's a lot that simply hasn't been determined yet. But okay. I'm happy to talk about what I can talk about.
Let's give this a try then. First of all, aren't you terrified to take on a
– Utterly terrified. On the other hand – I've written 27 books now. I do a book a year. I have a very I was going to use the word formula, very specific formula I use, and for I don't know why I hesitated, because it is a formula.
Because it has a downside, that word.
And it does. It's been used in some criticism. However, I would defy anyone who argues about a formula with the creation of a book or a movie to get into a car that had not been built according to a formula, or eat some food that had not been cooked according to a recipe or formula. I think a book should be exactly the same thing.
Well played.
But I have a pretty clear idea of how to put together a good solid thriller, and so I'm very comfortable about it. The one thing, however, I want to make absolutely sure I do is that I remain true to the fans that Bond has all over the world, the millions and millions of fans, and that I don't disappoint them. And that's in the back of my mind every time I sit down to, at this point, I'm working on the outline. I haven't started to write the book itself. But that's in the back of my mind every time I sit down, because this is for them. This is for them. And I want to make sure they like what I give them. And they also are very excited about the Deaver aspects of the book that I'm going to bring to the table.
Well, here, that sort of answers a question I had in the back of my mind, but I'll ask the question anyway because I want to hear your thoughts on it. James Bond – well, I started reading Bond because I was desperately in love with John Kennedy, and I knew that John Kennedy loved the Bond books. That's how I even heard of them in the first place.
Kennedy put Fleming on the map in America. He was, of course, wildly popular here, but then when Kennedy said he was, he may very well have said he's one of my favorite authors, but then bang, next day.
That was me.
So yeah. I don't know why Obama hasn't yet responded to the fact. I sent him an entire library of my books. He hasn't gotten back to me yet.
He'll get back to you, I'm
sure. I think he's busy.
Michelle is
moment.
Reading them right now, yeah. I guess the question I would have asked is, both John Kennedy and James Bond were relentless cold warriors during the Cold War. Mm-hmm. And that that mindset, that geopolitical thing, was the basis for so many great spy novels mm-hmm. over the years. I mean, sure, there's always been spies and there's always been spy novels, but the Cold War was very rich. A rich vein for that. Now, if the new James Bond was born in 1981, what's the milieu in which he will operate?
Sure. Well, a very good question. And when I was looking at the direction the story was going to go, and again, specifically, I can't really talk about that. But I was thinking back to the Cold War, and I'm a product of the duck and cover alerts, and I suspect many of your listeners are not familiar with that. But I growing up outside of Chicago. When we heard the air raid sirens go off, which we did with some frequency, we were taught to, I should add, just as a test, my small town was not bombed regularly in the 1950s. But when we heard the the alarm go off, we were to duck and cover. That meant we got under our desk in school and we covered ourselves or rolled over or something, as if a 300 megaton nuclear device would miss us and not melt us into a pure cinder in a fraction of a second. But nonetheless, that was the atmosphere we grew up in. And I can still remember in middle school, I was sitting in English class, and we had an announcement about a problem in Cuba, and that we were told to all go home because something bad could have happened. And, you know, frankly, we thought, cool, we get to go home. But then I remember watching on TV Walter Cronkite, probably, I don't specifically remember the newscast, but it was the Cuban Missile Crisis, and we stood up to Khrushchev and so on. Well, so that was a very spooky, paranoid time. But then I got to thinking, well, there never was a Soviet attack in America. There never was a Soviet attack in Madrid. There never was a Soviet attack in the London Underground. Now, some of that probably had to do with the clever espionage by people like James Bond and George Smiley, Le Carré's hero. But the fact is, we live, I think, in a far more perilous time now. And will Al-Qaeda be a villain in the book? Well, maybe, maybe not. But there certainly is no want of evil. If anything, though, I think the people's awareness of the horrors that can go on and the number of people who are willing to perpetrate those horrors exist out there. And, of course, then there's always the good Blofeld-type character. Now, Blofeld, you know, did not work for a state. He was, if anything, I guess we would say a non-state terrorist, mm-hmm. Like bin Laden. He tended to do it for
Stavro Blofeld.
Yeah, very good. Yes, what a name. What
yes.
Fleming came up with the best names.
Ulrich Goldfinger. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So the evil will still exist out there, but actually kind of changing the decimal point, that's all.
Mm-hmm. So I ask this and with great humility, when your James Bond book comes out, please come to Portland
I will be here.
Okay. Let me remind our listeners that I am speaking with Jeffrey Deaver. His last name is spelled D-E-A-V-E-R. And we're finally going to get to talk about your latest Lincoln rhyme book.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
I'm sure you forgot about it.
Yeah. I have the ISBN number memorized. I can't.
You have a tattooed on your leg. That'd be 26 numbers on your leg. Yeah. The Burning Wire is the title of it. The title itself is provocative in a way. Simon & Schuster is the publisher. Lincoln Rhyme, I just got asked this because I'm also a film critic. Did you like the Denzel Washington film?
I thought it was very good. I'm one of these authors that considers books and movies apples and oranges. And I'll tell you, if you ever have an author here sitting across from you as we're talking now, having a great conversation, and he or she says, oh, they made a movie out of my book, and they ripped my baby from my arms, they destroyed my child, it was a travesty, that's when I want you to ask, and when did you send the check back in protest? Because they never send the check back in protest. And the fact is, readers are very, very smart. If the movie is not quite parallel to the book or equal to the book, they know that. They know somebody else created the movie. It's really hard to put a movie together. It's a project by committee. And so that's why I have nothing to do with the making of the movies. I have a new film coming out in August on Lifetime Network, The Devil's Teardrop. It's a two-hour, maybe 3 hours, I'm not exactly sure, but it's an event. They don't call the movies anymore, it's an event.
Yeah. Yeah.
And once that was done, once I sold it, nothing more to do with it. I may review the script, but anyways, regarding The Bone Collector, I thought it was a good solid thriller. Best thriller ever made, but by far from the worst. So.
I just, the idea of taking a really kinetic actor like Denzel Washington and turning him into a quadriplegic, I thought that might have been not a good idea, but he showed that he could act with his face.
Well, if I understand now, of course, I never spoke to him, but I think he wanted to do the role for that very reason, because mm-hmm. he is a very physical character, and he thought this would be quite a stretch to play someone who could not move, could mm-hmm. blink his eyes or use facial expressions only.
Yep. Let's talk about The Burning Wire. Now, there's a large cast of characters here. I'm not going to attempt to go through all of them. Mm-hmm. But certainly we need to talk about Lincoln Rhyme and Amelia Sachs. Tell us what Lincoln Rhyme's condition is and why.
Sure. And for your – here I'm talking with a great deal of hubris, as if all your listeners know exactly who I am and who the characters
That's right.
are.
That's right. Yeah, maybe
the,
not.
My main character is Lincoln Rhyme. He is a forensic specialist, and everybody knows CSI now. He's a forensic detective. However, he is now really a private consultant, sort of a la Sherlock Holmes, because he was injured on the job when he was head of the crime scene unit in New York City. And a subway beam hit him on the back of the neck and broke his spine. And he's a C4 quadriplegic. That means a fourth cervical vertebrae was broken, paralyzed from the shoulders down, basically. And yet he is someone with an extremely active mind. And although he is paralyzed, from his relatively high-tech apartment on Central Park West, he advises the FBI and the New York City Police Department, working with both his professional and romantic partner, Amelia Sachs, who is now a detective on the force, detective third grade, and a few other folks who help them out. And I'll tell you, it was real interesting. When I came up with the idea for The Bone Collector, the original book in the series, it must be 12 years ago at this point, I thought, well, here's a good idea for a one-off book. I never thought it would be popular. I thought it was a good concept, a man who has to think. He has to think his solutions. You know, we've all seen the bad film, and I'm not going to mention any of them, but we all know who they are, actors who they get to the final scene of the film. And no, I'm sorry, I have to mention this one. I can't let this
go.
Okay, it was one of the Mission Impossibles with Tom Cruise and Philip Seymour Hoffman, who is one of my all-time favorite actors, and everything he is in is breathtaking. And he was the bad guy. And Philip Seymour Hoffman and Tom Cruise found themselves in that climactic scene toward the end where they're duking it out. And, of course, Tom Cruise, the hero, is at a disadvantage because Philip Seymour Hoffman is picking him up and throwing him into – they always have a lot of glass. If you notice that in those climactic scenes,
yes.
A lot of beakers. There were a lot of beakers crashing and windows crashing. And poor Tom Cruise is, you know, it looks like he's going to – this is it. Does anybody in the universe think that Philip Seymour Hoffman is going to beat up and prevail over Tom Cruise? Of course not. The only question is what rather cliche-ridden device is going to allow Tom Cruise to turn the tables? And sometimes it's nothing more than he gets a fresh breath of air and he goes and then beats up Philip Seymour Hoffman, however it is.
Rocky.
Well,
right.
Rocky. Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. Or the Die Hard films. Well, I wanted to create a hero. Now, and I should say, I've written those scenes. I'm not casting dispersions on them. I've certainly written those scenes. It's just that for this particular book, The Bone Collector, I wanted to do something different. I wanted a hero who had to outthink the villain in some way, do something clever to outthink him. And so that's the character I made. Well, all of a sudden, the book sold to a film company. The book started to sell in foreign countries. And once again, I'm not an idiot. This was a very popular character. So am I going to kill him off in the end? Oh, no. So he's come back, and he has proved to be extremely popular, my most popular series, and we'll continue to see them. And so this is now, The Burning Wire is now the ninth in the series.
So The Burning Wire, this is a killer who has managed to figure out a way to use the New York City electric grid to create havoc and murder in various locations. The very first one, I'm not giving anything away.
No, you can mention it. It's the opening scene
in
the book.
It's a city bus.
Yeah.
And there's a bus stop right next to a substation. Mm-hmm. And the next thing you know, this bus is, in effect, been fired at by a ray gun. It's been fried.
Yeah, and these are true. This is true. And I know that it's true because I found this research on the definitive source of all knowledge in the universe now. No, you're thinking it's Wikipedia. No. It's YouTube. It's YouTube. Go to YouTube and type in Arc Flash, ARC Flash. Arc Flash is a situation where voltage is like water pressure. Voltage is pressure. That's not how much electricity is. It's how much oomph is behind it. And if voltage builds up to a high enough level, it has to go somewhere. And it will jump out of the wire or out of the terminal to find a way to get back to the ground. And if that happens to be through you, you are going to be its route to the ground. You won't be left to talk about it afterwards. Or if it needs to jump to another piece of metal, it will hit a bus or do something like that. Well, I came up with the idea that I wanted, because I love to make my readers utterly paranoid. I love to just scare them to death. So I came up with the idea that, and this technically could happen, that if you play with the grid enough and move enough electricity to a place, these arc flashes will jump out, and you know, you can't aim it like a gun, but it's gonna cause a lot of havoc. But what I found was much more interesting, and the book's been out for about 10 days now, and this is the from my fan letters. This is what scares people the most. It's also fairly easy to get into your circuit breaker box or your fuse box in an office building or a restaurant or your home or your apartment and simply rewire it so that when you go to reach for the faucet, that's it. Bang, you're electrocuted. So I want my readers to think, it's time to get in the shower and wash their hair. And I'm not sure I want to touch that. They say to their husband or wife, honey, come in. Could you turn the water on for me, please? And so anyway, this villain is messing with electricity. We're not quite sure why he's doing it. Is he a terrorist? Is he out for revenge? Is he just a pure psycho? Because electricity is, you know, it's a fascinating topic. It really, I'm not a scientist, but if I understand correctly, it's how life got started. Billions of years ago, whenever
it was, that's the theory, yeah.
That lightning hit what's called the primordial soup, a mix of various chemicals and things that were inanimate. They were
amino acids, basically.
Amino acids, exactly, yeah. And that's the building blocks of life, and that's where life developed, and then we had amoeba, and then dinosaurs, and so forth. So we have electricity to thank for that, but it also the death penalty, electric chair. Takes life away. So I love those metaphors I was playing with.
I got two questions. First, are you a bit of a science geek? Because this book's first of all, the forensic science that's in the books is you know, we know that CSI is basically science fiction. Mm-hmm. Okay, mm-hmm. But I think you strive to be as truthful as possible about about the real forensic science.
All the forensic in there is taken from real cases, real situations, and I do that largely because people are quite aware, if not from CSI, which is of course fictional, but the Discovery Channel or A&E, they have shows about the forensic heroes and heroines with the police and FBI and other law enforcement agencies. So they know. I mean, you have to. We authors have to get that absolutely right. But yes, I find it fascinating. The electricity, I knew nothing about electricity, the difference between amperage and voltage and ohms, resistance. I learned that, put it in the book, learned quite a bit about energy in terms of the environment. Heaven knows, right at the moment, what's going on in the Gulf. That's rather, I don't specifically speak about the oil situation except to the extent that people want energy, and they are willing to turn away from the source if it's inconvenient for them. And it's chic to want a hybrid car, but it's interesting to note that there have been more sales of massive horsepower cars in the last 5 years than ever before. People are willing to pay a premium for the 8 and even 10 or 12 cylinder cars. So on the one hand, we do talk about the importance, and we recognize that. But are we willing to give up what we want for it? Well, that's another issue I talk about in the book.
Yeah, this is the common human condition. Even the guy who loves a bloody rare steak would not work in a slaughterhouse.
Exactly.
So, yeah. Another thing, I grew up in New York. Do you know of a guy named George Metesky?
No. Well, now wait a minute. Is he the He's not the
mad bomber.
The bomber. Sure,
yeah, yeah.
Sure.
It was a guy who worked for Con Ed and had a real beef with Con Ed.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, Con Ed things started blowing up.
Yes.
Transfer stations. You know, whatever it was. And then he got even nuttier, and he started blowing up things like trash cans, which had nothing to do, but I guess he just got into it, you know, and eventually they found the guy. And in those days, the forensic science was rudimentary.
Mm-hmm.
They had to do it by shoe leather and dogged persistence.
And I read that case, and those were actually quite some explosions. He was, you know, now we have some high-tech explosions like you see on, well, any movie now. Those are, you know, very sophisticated things. Dynamite still works, and it works really well, and I think that's what he used.
Yes,
with either burning fuses like you see in the Westerns. He may have had a clock fuse.
He had clocks
actually,
also.
Yeah, he was a very clever fellow.
Yes.
He actually was.
One went off in the place in the bus station where you keep your luggage, you know, that kind
yes,
of stuff.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, he got crazier and crazier as time went on. I got tell people what Locard's principle is.
Oh, Locard's principle is quite interesting. Locard was a criminalist. That is basically a fancy word for forensic science, Edmond Locard, and he lived in France, passed away in this century. He did most of his work, the last century. I'm a product of the 20th century, so I keep thinking in those terms. Mm-hmm. Let's say he was born in the mid to late 1800s and passed away in the early 20th century. And he worked in Lyon, France. And his theory was that any time a crime occurs, now, of course, at the time, we're not talking about internet crime. We're talking about a crime between a human being and a property or between two human beings. There is an exchange of some sort of physical evidence. And Locard put that in terms of dust. And we think of that as trace evidence now. But then he expanded beyond that very simple concept of trace evidence transferring from either the victim and and the killer, the perpetrator, or maybe the premises and the perpetrator. He expanded that to include maybe an impression evidence, the footprint in the mud, or a little bit of blood, an eyelash, for instance. But he said that in every crime, in every contact between a perpetrator and the victim, or the perpetrator and the premises, there is an exchange of evidence. And if you have enough patience and a clear enough eye, you will be able to find that, and that, in theory, should lead you to the perpetrator's identity. Back when he said it, it was quite revolutionary, because criminal science was, despite Sherlock Holmes, who, according to Conan Doyle, was about as brilliant as they came, and Doyle was really very clever, and did write about things that were not science fiction. He was grounded in science, but the police police procedure was far more rudimentary back then. Nowadays, you know, the stuff you see on CSI, it is a little it's a little far out, but most of that does exist.
Mm-hmm. This book, The Burning Wire, when you talk about the killer leaves something behind and picks up something from the crime scene, mm-hmm. one of the things, and I don't think I'm giving anything away here, is Tarama Salata, Greek. It's basically it's like caviar, but not.
I think it has more fat per square inch and sodium per square inch than anything else. But
it's delicious.
Fish eggs and it's like olive oil. Oh, it's
and
I
lemon
love
juice.
It.
Yeah,
and lemon
yeah,
juice.
Yeah,
I love
yeah,
it. Yeah.
Yeah.
sorry, we got. I'm getting hungry now.
I understand that. Yeah. Well, actually, you'd probably be able to go to lunch after this. So, are you working on anything besides the Bond outline?
Oh. Interesting you brought that up. I keep forgetting.
Have
I have
minute.
So much fun talking to you. I forgot.
I'm here
for shameless self-promotion. What was I thinking of?
Duh.
This coming fall in November, I will be publishing a one-off, a standalone book called Edge. And that is it's unique to my body of work because it is the first book I've written in the first person. What I wanted to do was get that sort of intimacy you have getting into the mind of a character and staying with him, in this case, throughout the whole book, and yet trying to work my twists and turns and surprises into the story. And it's proven to be quite a challenge, an enjoyable challenge, because, of course, all the information that will allow the twist to happen so that the reader says, I should have seen that. Not that, oh, he's cheating. He's pulling this information out at the last minute. But the information was there all along. All that information has to be accessible to my hero as much as the readers. So that's why it's been quite a challenge. And I'll, very briefly, I create a fictional and unnamed federal government agency that is charged with doing, I would call it, uber bodyguard work. When witness protection can't save anybody, when the FBI can't save anybody, they call my hero Cort, C-O-R-T-E, and his associates, and they get on the job, and they will do whatever they can to protect the innocent, and that'll be out in November. It will be called Edge.
It's been really wonderful talking to you. I wish this had gone on a little longer. The Burning Wire is the title of Jeff Deaver's latest book, published by Simon & Schuster. Please come back again.
Always fun. See you next year.